Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Ted Santos, and I am your host of The Creative Alchemist. And we come to you every Thursday at 7 o'clock until 8 o'clock. And we talk about business. It could be your business, the business you work for, the business you always wanted to start. And we do it by having guests who have, and our guests always have a very special expertise in one area of business. Sometimes they're entrepreneurs, and they always come on to talk about whether it's finance, leadership, project management, 401ks, across the board, many things. And tonight, well, will be no different. We're going to have a very special guest. And our guest is going to talk to you about something we haven't addressed, and I'm sure it's been on your mind for many of you. And before we introduce our guest, you know I never take this journey alone. You have to meet my co-pilot, Lori. Let them know you're in the house.
Hi, Lori Miller from LGC Interior Design. Thank you for joining us yet again. We're nearing over 2,000 listeners in just about a year, so it's super exciting, and Ted and I are ever so grateful. And once again, we're here to help you with your business, start a business, own a business, no matter what point you're in. And tonight we have a special guest. I'm going to let her introduce herself, and, you know, she's all about helping you fulfill your vision on your business. So, Karen, please introduce yourself and tell everybody who you are, what you do, how to get a hold of you, what to look for, and we've got a lot of questions.
Well, that's where to start. Thank you, Lori. Thank you, Ted. Hi, everyone.
Thank you.
Happy Thursday. Happy evening. My name is Karen Signorachi, and I've spent the last 20 years consulting for nonprofit organizations and trade associations, helping them set vision, helping the board of directors stay organized, raising money, community outreach, helping these types of organizations run like a business. Not that their mission is to be cold or businesslike, because a lot of them are helping and serving a large portion of people that really need their services, but the business side of it needs to be in order so they can optimize all of the opportunities in front of them.
It's a good way to put
Very
it.
Very cool. And you've helped a lot of not-for-profits. How did you get – I'm just curious how you got started and how you made this the ideal business for you.
Well, I started on the event side. I started – I was working at a high school, and every May, the first Thursday in May, they had a scholarship gala to raise money for scholarships. And it was a great party, and we raised a lot of money. And I got to see both sides of it. I got to see us approach banks and law firms and businesses for sponsorship. And I got to see the flowers and the caterer and the colors and all of it come together. And for me, that was kind of a critical moment, because I was so excited about the lead-in, you know, the prep and the leading up to that night and the messaging and the emotion when you were there. And that stayed with me. So from there, I worked for a number of nonprofits in fundraising and community outreach and, you know, raising millions of dollars with a team of people for a particular mission or cause or whatever might need to get done, playgrounds, capital campaigns, renovations. I never lost sight, though, of that first year and how – the two worlds came together, a party and fundraising.
And they do. Very
Everyone
nice.
Everyone loves a good party.
That's right.
Yes, they do. And I guess, how would you start to even begin to help a business? Like, what some questions, some thoughts? How do you work around that?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of variables, and there's no two nonprofits, there's no two businesses, and no two associations that are alike. If you wanted to start a nonprofit, you know, the first thing I always tell people is, is, you know, get two or three people that are willing to work with you and strategize with you and be part of your board of directors, because you have to have a board of directors or trustees.
Mm-hmm.
The word is interchangeable.
Well,
okay.
Let me ask you. So I've built a number of boards for businesses, for-profit companies, and usually middle market. And one of, you know, I've noticed when you're recruiting these high caliber board potential board members, one of the first questions they ask is, do you have, or does your client have D&O insurance, which is directors and officers? So is that important for nonprofits? If so, what is it? Yeah, so there's like three questions. Is it important for nonprofits? Should they have them? And if someone is thinking about sitting on a board, should they be looking to see if the organization has that kind of insurance?
Absolutely, Ted. You know, that's just a good business decision, you know, to inquire if you were to be asked or decide to join a board of directors, to make sure they have just general board of directors insurance. And that just covers, you know, any decisions that the board makes, that they'll be, it really would protect the individual board member from any sort of personal potential lawsuit or anything terrible like that. And we don't even want to think like that. But directors and officers insurance is just insurance policy for the board of directors, and the financial responsibility and the shareholder and strategic visions that they settings that they have to plan out. And it's a very important decision. You wouldn't drive a car without car insurance. So think of it the same way.
Really? So
well,
even for not-for-profits, that's interesting. I mean, you know, for-profits, you understand if there's fraud or anything goes wrong, board members don't want to be personally liable, so the insurance mitigates the risk of lawsuit to, you know, the individuals who sit on the board. But you should be looking for that also in a not-for-profit.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes. Without a doubt.
So is there anything – so if I were going to sit on a not-for-profit tomorrow and I'm sitting on the board of your organization, what would I be looking for? Would I want to see your policy? Or should I just assume and take in good faith you have it?
Well, there's a couple things you should be looking for besides just directors and officers insurance. You know, the first thing, obviously, is making sure they are covered with directors and officers insurance. And the second thing that they should have is, you should look at their financial statements, their budget, their audited financial statement, their 990 report, which is actually a tax return for nonprofits. You should find out what committees they have, what the commitment is for those committees, what they entail, the descriptions. You should find out how often the board meets, keeping in mind that you're not there just to show up at a board meeting, give your 2 cents, and then walk out of the room to forget about it, you know, until the next board meeting. The work of the board is really done, you know, in between the board meetings on a committee. And that's where the real work gets done. And at the board meetings, you're, you know, making decisions, maybe setting, again, overall strategy. The other thing I would ask for is there some sort of training or board manual or a board Bible, as I like to call it, that outlines for you the mission of the organization, the programs, the staff, dates that you need to keep in mind, board meeting dates. You're basically your board Bible, your playbook. And you would want to know that you have maybe a board buddy or someone that's going to walk you through your first few months.
Okay.
A board buddy,
I hear,
love that.
I hear that in the 990 report, there's something on page 10 that you should pay attention to. Is that correct? Is that correct?
So Ted, honestly, page 10 is your synopsis. You know, it's basically where the organization is spending their money. And so you're going to see all the things that you should see in any sort of business. occupancy, salaries, insurance, legal fees, accounting fees. But the things you also want to look for are program expenses. You also want to look at what they're spending on marketing, you know, what they're spending on travel or conferences, professional development, maybe even what they're spending on networking and being in the community and getting involved. So you can look at page 10 and you can get a real idea of what the expenses are. And if anything's glaring, numbers don't lie, as we always say. You'll see it right in front of you.
Okay. I think you used the word synopsis, right? So you'll have a really good idea as to what's going on in terms of finances.
Yeah.
From that one page. Okay. All right. Very good. And is there anything else you should look for if you're considering to sit on a board?
Well, I think it starts with an internal conversation. Do you feel an emotional connection to the mission? Do you have passion for what they're doing and what they stand for? Do you have the time? Most people are protective of two things, their time and their money. And I will tell you, quite frankly, Ted and Lori, I have found over the years, people are more protective of their time in certain instances than they are of their money. So really examine, do you have the time to commit to it? Because the worst thing you could do is what we call become a BINO, board member in name only. So your name's on the roster, your name's on the website, people in the organization have never seen you. Your fellow board members have never met you. You don't want to do that.
Right.
You know. Then it looks like you're just trying to pad your resume or just, just do some soul searching. If you're going to do it and you commit to it, do it all the way.
Okay.
So I guess before we even talk about like considering to sit on a board, I've always heard that in order to be on a board, like you have to pay for the seat. So if someone really wants to be on a board and that, you know, and their mission is really where aligns with their mission, how does one get on a board?
Well, this is an interesting topic, Lori, and the paying for the seat in the nonprofit world is sometimes called the give-get. And so there are some nonprofits, and it's going to vary. We could have 10 nonprofits in front of us, and they're going to be 10 different scenarios. But some of them will ask their board members, you have a commitment to either give or get. So either you give it yourself or you raise it from friends, family, your company, X amount of money. You know, and the give-get could be $5,000, it could be $10,000, it could be $25,000. Some nonprofits feel like that's a way of having the board member skin in the game, that they're committed to the organization. Another approach is that, you know, they're giving of their time. We don't have to put a dollar amount around it per se, but we like our board members to make a financial contribution. So that can vary. You could ask my other colleagues and consultants. Everyone will have a different opinion on it. But that's typically what people might, if they don't do their research, might not be clear on as far as what the cost, the actual financial cost would be.
Very interesting. Okay. Right. So it's not really like you're buying a seat. I mean, you're just investing in something you believe in anyway.
That's the perfect way to put it. Yes.
Okay. That makes more sense.
It's not necessarily that they're looking for you to write them a check. It's she said give or get. So either write a check or your company, or you go out and raise the money through other executives that you know to write a check. So if it's $25,000, it doesn't matter how you come up with it, your personal paycheck or five people wrote a check for, you know, $5,000.
Right.
Yeah, that's a great, nonprofits are also looking for, you know, we always used to say in the Girl Scouts, make new friends, but keep the old. One is silver, the other is gold. You know, nonprofits are looking to do the same. You want to make some new friends, and maybe your board of directors can bring some new friends and some new blood and new prospects, new donors, but you want to keep your old faithful and loyal ones too. And
right.
You know, that kind of leads into why board members should have a term limit. You know, you're there for 2 years or 3 years or 4 years. No one should be there in perpetuity. That's good for the board to have new eyes, new ears, new thought processes. And it's also good for getting new traffic in, because every person is going to bring a different set of their own world, their own context.
Right. Okay.
Very good.
All right.
So,
and how many people?
Go ahead. Sorry, Ted. No, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Lori.
So if it's not a not-for-profit, or I didn't know if you were still staying on that topic, Ted.
No, keep going.
It's not a not-for-profit, right? How does someone really create a vision or create a plan that aligns with their vision?
I mean, it could be the same way you would approach, starting a business. You know, some soul searching, some real deep thinking. You know, what you almost have to back yourself into it. You know, what do you see 10 years down the line or 20 years down the line? You know, what do you see as a final product, and how do you take the step to get there?
That's interesting, because, you know, obviously every successful, marketer or business person has said you start at the back and then work your way to the very beginning to figure out how to get there. So, and you're saying the same thing, like it doesn't matter what you're doing. You want to start at the end and then kind of figure out the plan to get to that point.
You know, I think about it as, like, you know, one of the greatest skills you can have in business is empathy. And, you know, in the fundraising world, in the nonprofit world, that's, you know, putting yourself in the place of the donors. You know, what are they going to want to hear about me asking them for money? And, you know, what is this board member going to want to hear about, you know, the state of the organization? So I think about that the same way with starting a business or starting any new effort. At the end game, what am I going to want to hear about what's been accomplished? Mm-hmm. And then how do you make it happen?
Interesting. Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, because a lot of business owners, they just start. They're like, oh, I think I can run a business, and this is what I want to do, and, you know, I'll be a painter and I'll paint houses. And then you're like, okay, this isn't really working out the way I thought. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, when you're kind of saying it's good to have a business plan, it's good to have a marketing plan, it's good to know what you're up against and to have your goals clearly laid out and to have, a specific plan.
It doesn't have to be formalized in a 25-page, you know, warm and peace type of document. You could have it on cocktail napkins,
right,
where we know. You know, you could have it on in the back of a notebook, but just have some sort of vision and something, you know, written down that that you can rely on when you get in the weeds, when you get stuck with the problem, when you are painting houses and realize that you can't, you have more houses to paint than people to paint them. And you could ask any entrepreneur, any business owner, you know, the roadblocks that they encountered helped them refine their vision and redefine and fine tune it.
Right. And I guess that another topic, right, is you run a networking group, which also, you know, has very seasoned people. So, and that's like another thing to do is, you know, to join something where you can bounce off of like-minded people who think like you and have the same and hold the same values. And then ask them, oh, did you ever encounter this? Because you have the same sort of experience.
You know, there's a lot of value in networking. And this comes from someone that's an entrepreneur, someone that maybe is working for a nonprofit and, you know, raising money and raising awareness. Someone that's just starting out, now, there's a lot of value in building those relationships. And there's a give-get in that. You have to give back. You have to think about, you know, how you could help other people. And then you have to think about, I need advice, or I need a recommendation, or, you know, I need some help. And And those things don't happen overnight. You know, a lot of the networking that we see, it's not a one-off transactional type of relationship. There's meals involved. Maybe you meet someone for breakfast. You meet them for lunch. Maybe you have a phone call. Like I always joke around, we've become very accustomed to Zoom. But, you know, the phone, you know, you dial it and it rings. what a novel idea.
What a concept.
What a concept. But that's part of networking, you know.
Right.
And sometimes you just have to call people and say thank you. You know, I used to do this with some of my nonprofit clients. I used to say call, you know, 5 or 7 donors and just say thank you. Thank you for what you've done. Thank you for giving. And they would do it, and they would be so surprised because people would say, well, what do you want? What's wrong? What happened? No, I'm not calling for anything. I'm not calling because I need something. I'm just calling to say thank you. And, Lori, maybe that's something to think about with networking too. You know, just call some people and say, hey, thank you. You know, thank you for being a sounding board. Thank you for that referral. You know, thank you for reaching out to me.
Yeah, well, the thank you is always, you know, it's just a nice thing in general. You know, nobody ever says thank you anymore. You're usually getting yelled at or, right, or arguing with somebody. So that thank you is usually important. I definitely appreciate that. So, and I know, Ted, I interrupted you. Sorry.
No, you're fine. If someone would like to call in and say thank you or say hello to Karen and ask her a question, the phone number is 516-387-1640. That's 516-387-1640. So we've been talking about sitting on a board of directors. So what if you want to, and we talked about a vision, come with a vision, and we kind of touched on talking about networking, but where we started a few minutes ago was if you have a vision and you want to start a board, I mean, how difficult? Can you just kind of walk us through, like, you know, once you've done some soul searching and there's a something you want to stand for and build a nonprofit organization, what's involved in starting one, even before you get to a board of directors? So what's that, how complicated is it?
Well, Ted, you know, there's one starting place I would suggest to anyone, and that's before you start another nonprofit, especially on Long Island, which last tally I had was over 5,000 nonprofits. Make sure there's not someone doing the exact work that you have in mind, because then you're duplicating efforts. And, you know, the perfect example of this is on Long Island is about 12 or 15 breast cancer charities. And if they could get together, they could take over the world. But they all are very siloed to some extent. So I would just make sure there's not already somebody doing the work and the mission. If you've determined this is what you want to do and you want to start a nonprofit and you want to you know, help campers or underprivileged kids get to camp and you want to go for it, then the first thing you need to do is file with the IRS. You need to file a 1023 form. You can find it on the IRS website. The IRS did us a favor a number of years ago. It was about a 40-page document, and they scaled it down to 13. So they actually called it 1023 EZ. I don't know exactly what's easy about it because it's a 13-page document you have to complete. But so you have to file 1023, and you can get a really good nonprofit accountant to do that. I do know some people that have endeavored to do it themselves, but it really, you want a professional to do that. You need to file, prepare articles of incorporation, and you need to register with the New York State Charities Bureau. So those are just a couple of things you need to, you know, kind of on the business side, get in order. Now, if you have people listening in other states, you know, you would want to find out from your local state. I know New York, you know, what you have to do if they have their own version of a charities bureau, or, you know, what the New York State guidelines are, other states' guidelines are, I'm sorry. So that's a couple of steps you need to take. You know, you also need to think about making sure the name you have in mind isn't already taken, forming the board, which we already kind of talked about. You need to have a mission statement, a vision statement. You need to have, you know, an outline of what programs you want to provide. Again, some of those things you would consult, you know, a nonprofit accountant or attorney that can help you with those documents.
Okay. And so is it as the same as running a business? I mean, you were talking in the beginning of our show about helping people fulfill their vision, but do it in a sort of a professional way. Is running a nonprofit, and is we hear the term nonprofit and not-for-profit. Are they the same thing?
Oh, yeah. So those terms are interchangeable. Yes. So I think the big thing that people need to keep in mind is that one of the big things is, you know, nonprofits can have a profit. They can have a profit at the end of the year. There's nothing wrong with that. They're not supposed to all be break-even, you know, balanced entities. But that profit that they would have, they have to put back into the organization, maybe hiring more staff, maybe enhancing a program, maybe upgrading some technology, maybe spending some money on marketing. You're in a for-profit situation. If a company makes a profit, the board members get their nice check, which is wonderful and well and good. But in a nonprofit scenario, that's not the case. The board members are there devoting their time, devoting their strategy, but there's not a check at the end of the year. And, you know, like I said in the beginning, any nonprofit, they need to run it like a business. You need to have, depending upon the size, someone in charge of finance, someone in charge of operations, someone in charge of human resource. You know, you have to keep in mind from a business standpoint, 1 in 14 people are employed by a nonprofit in this country.
Hmm.
And the nonprofit industry tremendously contributes to the gross national product. So you have nonprofits that could be $20, $25 million operations, and you have some that could be running a $250,000 operation. They're still employing people. They're still contributing to society. They're still have expenses, such as insurance and accounting and legal fees and rent, and some of them own property, so they have mortgage payments. So there's a lot that goes into it that requires time and effort.
Okay. All right. So you can't have a profit. And I guess that would show up on page 10 of that 990 report. So if I were looking at a not-for-profit, is that a good sign if I was considering to sit on a board to see they have a profit? Is that usually a good sign?
I think it's a great sign to see they have a profit, yes. You know, truthfully, just like any organization, the concern is when you look at a 990 report, you see a deficit. But when you see a profit and then you see what they're putting it into, some of them are putting it in an endowment. And, you know, that's a great saving opportunity. That's a legacy. That's the future. You know, and with an endowment, you know, you really can't touch the principal. You just have a policy on the investment, on the interest, I'm sorry, and you live off some of that interest and you take some of that. But an endowment is a great way, and putting it back into the organization. Not a lot of nonprofits, maybe like a lot of for-profits right now, are short-staffed. You know, in the traditional nonprofit, even before the current situation of COVID, you had 8 people doing the work of 16. Because mm-hmm. they often are, you know, the resources can be limited.
Okay. And so how do you find board members, though? I mean, so are all these not-for-profits filling the board seats with their friends and family? Is that how it works?
No, you can't do that because the IRS is pretty pretty strict on that one. You know, it would be definitely a red flag. It's funny you say that because one of my first clients, there was a family foundation. All their children were on the board. And the first thing I did when I got there, I said, we have to take off all but one because the IRS will see that as a, you know, it looks like it's a family power play. But how are people getting board members? You know, people in the community, maybe business owners that they know, maybe some of their donors, maybe people that have attended their events, someone that's expressed interest in the mission, someone maybe that has donated their time. You know, it has to be the right fit. I always joke around, sometimes your biggest donor isn't your best board member. Maybe they just want to write you a check every year, and that's fine. You know, maybe someone that is on a committee spends some time on a committee and then moves up to a board position after kind of getting their feet wet. I mean, it's a great way to date and court and kind of find out about somebody is to have them on a committee first and then see if they how they work out. But it's an ongoing process for board recruitment. You know, it shouldn't be something that just happens, oh, my God, we need somebody. Let's hurry up and find somebody. It should be ongoing. It should be like prospecting. And I always joke around. I always say good people know good people. So if you have a couple of great people on your board, chances are the tentacles go out and they know somebody else.
Okay.
Excellent. So who would want someone reach out to if they wanted to be on a board, like another board member or just write a letter to the not-for-profit?
I mean, before jumping on and becoming a board member, I would get to know them first, go to an event, find out a little bit more about what they do, and then, you know, introduce yourself to the right people and go from there. But definitely find out first a little bit more about what they do and what they're about and, you know, what their needs are, what they're looking to.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of nonprofits that would serve more people if they could and, you know, are trying to grow.
Right. Very good. Very good. Now, are you on board or personally, or do you help? Like, how do you work? What are your, I guess, biggest points or I don't know how you put it.
So right now, Lori, I am not actively sitting on any boards, and I'm okay with
mm-hmm.
that.
Right.
I have done it over the course of my career, you know, the last 10 years or so. I've even, mm-hmm. you know, chaired a few boards. You know, wow. Right now my commitment is to my clients and the work that they're doing. And with some of my clients, I do a board retreat or a board kind of a board vision meeting where
mm-hmm.
we put away the actual work that needs to be done, looking at the finances, looking at the marketing, and really talk about strengths and weaknesses and 5 years down the line and 10 years down the line.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually work with a couple of boards right now that I'm, you know, helping them with the succession plan. They have one
mm-hmm.
board in particular. They have a wonderful gentleman, but he's been there for, you know, 6 years, and they need to find someone that's his replacement. So I'm working
okay.
on a succession plan, and then, you know, one person can change a whole table. So you have we always like
right.
to say board should be 9, 11, or 13. You always want an odd number. So
huh.
you have 9 people, and you add one more. Well, say you add 2 more. The whole table changes. The whole dynamic changes. So that's what a lot of my work is right now with some of my nonprofit clients.
And one of the questions I think is important for someone, if you're building a board or considering to sit on one, my understanding, a lot of not-for-profits have working boards. So can you talk about what that means? And if you have started a board, how important is it to communicate to a potential board member that this is a working board and what that entails?
Well, a more green nonprofit is going to have more of a working board that's actively involved in a lot of the decision-making and writing and planning. And that's probably going to be their starting point to get them, you know, off the ground. to get the organization off the ground. A more seasoned board, you know, you're there to set strategy, to set vision. Some of the work might be done in committee, and then they report to the board on decisions that need to be made and strategy. But I would say if it is a more established board, it's less work in between and more being present for making major decisions, hiring, financial, maybe if it's real estate related, are we buying property? Are we renting a long-term lease? Things like that.
Right. Now, if it's a more junior organization, a working board, that might mean you're finding event space and negotiating the fees, right? There are just various. So you may the organization may not have the staff to carry out all the tasks. Does that mean the board members are fulfilling those tasks themselves?
It could be. It could be the board members. It could be the board members getting more volunteers. It could be the board members going to their own personal resources, friends, family, colleagues. I have found, and this is my experience, and there could be exceptions to the rule. There always are. I have found my work with more seasoned and, you know, more junior growing boards is it's like all hands on deck type of thing. It doesn't matter what your position is. Doesn't matter where you came from. We got a job to do. We're going to get it done. Example I'll give you of that was, many years ago, there was a food pantry that started in Hempstead. It was started by a bunch of Hofstra kids. And they did everything. They made food. They reached out to the community to let people know they were opening their doors. I mean, they did it all. And that was their approach. And it worked.
Right. Yeah. I just for anyone that's considering to start one that it would be wise to make sure you let your potential board members that know that you need some specific expertise that they have, and they all, like you said, all hands on deck. So that may include raising money, fundraising, right? The board members, or you may have. So what are all the ways that a board can fundraise?
Well, like any financial advisor would tell us in relation to, you know, money and your portfolio, fundraising is the same way, and you want to be diverse. So, you know, think of it as like a pizza, and think about the slices you could have on a pizza. So you want some of the money to come from events, such as the scholarship gal I spoke of in the beginning, maybe golf outings, maybe cocktail parties, maybe art shows, things of that nature. You would potentially could receive some money, depending upon the work that you do as an organization, from New York State, federal, or on the federal level. There are grants that you can apply for that is funding from New York State, and there's also federal grants.
Wait, I'd like to ask a question about that. So do you need a grant writer to do that, or should you just do it yourself?
For the federal and the state grants, you definitely need someone that has expertise in those areas. As you might imagine, there are a lot of hoops that you need to go through to secure that money. So it's not for the faint of heart. And there are a lot of great, I can name three, great grant writers that specialize in just state and federal funding. So that's one slice.
So they're worth their weight in gold then because of all the hoops you jump through.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And just one more on that. Mm-hmm. So if you're able to get a grant from the federal government, it doesn't mean that you get it for the next 10 years. You have to reapply. Is it true you have to reapply every year if it's a one-year grant?
Most of them are 1 or 2 years. You do have to reapply, but even more importantly than reapplying, you have to submit an end-of-the-year report so they know what you use their money for, because they want to make sure you're using it what you said you were going to use it for. So So, yeah, that's very much part of the plan, Ted.
Okay. All right. All right. And that's kind of, to me, sounds like when you said it's good to make new friends, right? So if the federal government is giving you a grant that's a new friend, you don't want to – does it matter what kind of relationship you have with the people in that overseeing that particular grant? Like, do you need to make them friends so that you are almost guaranteed the next time the grant comes up?
With time constraints, you know, they're gonna read the proposal that you send them, and they're gonna, you know, review it. And it's, unfortunately, it's a little bit on the transactional side. You know, I would hope that sometimes there's a little bit more of a relationship there, but it's gonna depend on the parties involved.
Okay. Okay. All right. Can be very transactional. Got it. All right. And the grant writer understands how that transaction works, and so they're worth the investment. All right.
But in addition to, you know, what you were saying about fundraising, you know, there's other grants that a nonprofit could pursue from family foundations or local foundations, which can be a little less cumbersome than the federal and state grants. And then, you know, a lot of nonprofits are targeting individual donors. Most nonprofits receive 70 to 75% of their support from individual donors, families, people in the community that you know, are willing to make a sacrifice and be stewards of philanthropy and make a donation. That's where most of your funding will come from.
I lived in D.C. and there were some public interest groups that would literally go door to door, like Greenpeace or something like that. Is that something you would recommend, like knocking on everyone's door in the neighborhood?
I wouldn't, no, because there's no way to really stand out, unfortunately. You know, there's other ways you can get involved in your community, you know, maybe joining a local networking group, joining a Rotary Club, getting involved with the Chamber of Commerce. You know, think about how much better it would be to go to a meeting that the Chamber's setting up than knocking on somebody's door and telling them about the organization. So there's other ways you can get involved in the community, and then you can have potential supporters there, potential board members, potential committee members, potential honorees for an event. You know, you could just grow your wings, spread your wings, I should say.
So what if someone is this perpetually, like, I'm shy, I'm not good at networking, like, should they just not create a not-for-profit, or should they come talk to you about how to network? I mean, what does one do? Because they exist, the shy introvert who has a great cause, and now they need to fundraise, and networking is not their forte.
Well, in some way, shape, or form, somebody needs to be the face of it. You know, any large nonprofit or medium nonprofit, there is one person that's the face of it. You know, and they are potentially simultaneously providing the service, providing the programs, and then out there raising money and shaking hands and, you know, kissing babies, like we always, you know, joke around and say. So if you want to stay on the behind-the-scenes part, you're going to have to find somebody to be the front man. And if you want to be the front man, you're going to have to find somebody to be behind the scenes. There are some people that can do both, and I've seen it. And there are some people, just like you said, Ted, that they struggle with the external part. But the internal part is a piece of cake.
I assume that's rare for someone to do them both, or is it common?
I would say it's rare. To do them both well, even more rare.
Interesting. Okay. Very interesting. And so is giving events, is that really a big deal? I mean, do all nonprofits give events? I mean, can you get away with not doing them?
This is very interesting, because I've told my clients for years that you have to get away from the big events. And if you're not pulling 15 to 20 people from an event that you can follow up with afterwards, that you can engage a relationship with, that, you know, can be a potential board member or donor, then you're just having a party for, you know, the sake of having a party. You know, the event should have a purpose. They should have, a call to action. People should leave there feeling like, okay, I need to do this, this, and this now, or I want to be more involved. And unfortunately, with March 2020 taking place, you know, events were canceled. And nonprofits had to recalibrate. And the ones that had an active donor base, I told a lot of my clients, we're going to pick up the phone and we're going to call donors. And we're going to tell them, here's what we're doing, here's how we pivoted, and we need your help. And so events are great, and they serve their purpose. But they cannot be the end-all, be-all. And the most dangerous part in some of the events is that I always joke around, too, you know, golf outing can raise $125,000, $150,000 because a lot of money is made that day when people are there buying raffles and participating. You are one thunderstorm away from that day being half of the amount that you wanted. So, you know, I'm hesitant to put all your eggs in one basket because it could be problematic.
Absolutely. So I just want to interrupt if anyone wants to call in. Please, we have about 10 more minutes, so feel free. And, and Karen, if you want to tell them how to get in touch with you, because obviously if anyone wants to start a not-for-profit, you would for sure be the person to call.
Sure. So you can send me an email at Karen, K-A-R-E-N, at K-A-R-E-N, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, S as in Sam.com. You can also give me a phone call, 516-459-9386. I promise that if I can't get to you in that current moment, I will call you back. So I'll say that again, Karen, K-A-R-E-N, at karenscs.com or 516-459-9386.
Excellent. Thank you, Karen. Thank you. Yeah, not-for-profits are so important. You know, they really are, and they do help people, and you know, they're very rewarding. I mean, you know, I always talk about what I do and my fundraising, and, you know, that's such an important part of who I am. So, what you do is extremely valuable, and thank you. Thank you very much for helping us.
You're welcome. You know, do you find that most people, they have some sort of affinity or connection to some sort of nonprofit or mission, and there's an emotional connection for why a lot of people do what they do, whether it's on a volunteer basis or a professional basis. And, you know, I'm just happy that I have the opportunity to meet all these wonderful people through the course of my career that are giving of their time and their money to help somebody else.
Right.
Out of curiosity, if you have staff, I assume you're not paying them the same salaries you would pay a for-profit company. So, like, is there a way to calibrate salaries for nonprofits?
I mean, that's going to be completely dependent on each organization, and you know, you might be surprised to find there are some nonprofit jobs that are high-paying, that are on the higher salary end, and you might find some that are more more grassroots. It's going to depend on the organization. It's going to depend on how much money they're bringing in from either program revenue, rental revenue, fundraising, federal money, state money. The trick to it is to balance out the revenue and the expenses, even more so where there's potentially more revenue, as we talked about before.
Right. Okay. So if you So I do understand there are people who may volunteer. You have working boards. If you really want high caliber talent, you're going to have to pay salaries that come closer to a business.
Sure, they're going to have to be
commiserate. Is that a good way to put it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're going to have to be commiserate with the experience. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right.
I always also joke around, like, you know, nonprofits, they need people of all shapes and sizes. You know, they need good accountants, they need good attorneys, whether they outsource it or they have somebody on staff. They need qualified social workers, they need people that are adept in human resources. So, you know, they need a little bit of everybody.
And to your knowledge, there are no board members that ever get paid on a nonprofit, correct?
No. No, that would be highly unethical. Actually, I'm not a lawyer, but it could even be, you know, a precarious legal situation.
Interesting. Okay. All right. I know after the whole Enron and WorldCom that that's where a lot of the Sarbanes-Oxley made boards much more accountable than they had been in the past. They used to call them rubber stampers, and you had a name for people who just show up. Are non-for-profits, were they affected by the whole Sarbanes-Oxley and how they have to hold board members accountable? I mean, yeah, how does that work?
Well, there is most organizations, like I said before, they give you this, you know, your board Bible when you get started. And there's a code of ethics that each organization would include in that would align with their principles and how they want to conduct business. And, you know, the Sarbanes-Oxley was concerning for a lot of organizations of all shapes and sizes. But if anything, it taught us, I think, the integrity of your data, of maintaining, you know, good policies and protocol, not getting lazy, but keeping, you know, valuable information close to the vest.
Okay. So if you have, so they're on for-profit boards. Sometimes if there is a breakdown, something, and maybe I'll wait that for a second. So let's say you mentioned a new lease agreement. Would you want your board members to be involved in a lease agreement in negotiating it with a landlord?
I mean, I would say that there's two ways that could unfold. You know, on most boards, there's an executive committee that's comprised of the chairperson, the vice chairperson, the secretary, and the treasurer. And sometimes they would handle details of that nature. The other part of that is if you have somebody with the skill set in that arena, you know, maybe you have a commercial realtor sitting on the board, you know, they might be of a resource in this situation where they're offering their professional advice. You know, they're offering their counsel. They're certainly not getting paid on it or have any vested interest in that way. But, you know, that's why, a good board has a finance person, a realtor, someone that has an educational background, entrepreneurship. You know, you want a diverse set of people because you're going to need all those skill sets for different avenues and different things that are going to occur.
Right, an attorney, right, yeah. Right. Okay. All right. So the organization would be looking for their professional expertise. They would be looking for advice. Now, is this where the D&O insurance comes? So let's suppose you're an attorney and there's an agreement and you missed something. Is that attorney that's a board member liable in any way?
No, that would come under Beverly Park Directors and Officers Insurance. That definitely
okay.
would be.
That's what I thought. Okay. All right. Now, and sometimes on boards, if there's an emergency meeting, does that happen with not-for-profits, or is that just something a committee Is there something that's an emergency, the specific committee would deal with that?
There certainly could be emergency board meetings to deal with the crisis, to deal with staffing issue, to deal with the resignation, to deal with a death. And you'd want to follow Robert's Rules of Order like you would for any meeting. You want to have a quorum. You know, you want to have someone taking minutes. You want to have, you know, a close to the meeting, a start to the meeting, and a close to the meeting. If there's a vote, you want to capture that. But there certainly, you know, unfortunately, for more bad reasons than good, have been emergency board meetings.
Right. Cybersecurity.
Sure.
A breach. Yeah. Actually, that's been a big issue in the past few years, cybersecurity. Are not-for-profits talking about that also?
Oh, of course. You know, and keeping, you know, your firewall. Again, you're not only managing your website, but you have a database of donors, of potentially participants.
Right.
You know, so actually, I'm remiss in saying this. A good board would have a good IT person on there, too. They are worth their weight in gold also.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Any final words of wisdom for someone starting a board, not-for-profit, or someone looking to take theirs to the next level? Final words of wisdom.
As simple as it sounds, go with your gut. If you have a real emotional connection, emotional charge, and you're being called to something, then follow that. If you have the hesitancy and you're not sure if it's the right time, follow that too. You know, just go with your natural instincts. It won't lead you wrong.
Okay, that's pretty simple.
That is.
So I want to thank
Karen,
you for joining us this
so
evening.
Much.
I enjoyed our time together, and I enjoyed our conversation. I thank you for the great questions and commentary and the chance to discuss all these wonderful things.
Thank you, and we appreciate it. And once again, if people want to get a hold of you.
Sure, 516-459-9386, or you can send me an email, Karen, K-A-R-E-N, at Karen, K-A-R-E-N, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, S as in Sam.com.
All right.
Perfect.
Thank you so much, Karen.
Oh, you're welcome, Laura. You're welcome, Ted. Have a good night. Great to be together.
Thank you. Have a good evening. Good night, everyone.
And everyone will see you. Yeah, good night, everyone. We'll see you next week.